I know that the younger generation is angry, angry at us. And I have heard so many 18, 17 year olds truly feeling anxious that they have no future. They are saying to me, why should I think about what I want to study in college when there is no planet that I can live on? And that eco-anxiety was not my generation. I did not grow up in high school worrying about the planet, basically.
This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show. This session of the radio show shares my conversation with Natalia Linos, State Rep Jeff Roy, and Dr. Michael Walker-Jones. These three folks are joined by Frank Falvey as the host and Pete Fasciano, Franklin TV and Radio's executive director, for a weekly conversation on the broad topic of our democratic republic. This particular session gets into the why have the new show Towards a More Perfect Union, which is its title. Jeff opens the discussion on why with a reading of our constitutional preamble. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. We had our conversation via conference bridge to adhere to the social distancing requirements of this pandemic period. The show is broadcast on WFPR on Mondays at 11, 2 p.m., and 8 p.m. A podcast version of the show is also in development, so if you missed the radio time slot, you can still listen. Links to the panel profiles are included in the show notes. The recording runs about 51 minutes, so let's listen to my conversation with Natalia, Jeff, and Michael. This is Steve Sherlock for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, WFPR.FM, anywhere on the internet, and on 102.9 on the radio dial. Today, we've got an interesting session to get some insights into Towards a More Perfect Union, a new radio show on WFPR-FM. Let me welcome Natalia Linos. Good morning, Natalia.
Good morning, Steve.
And our state representative, Jeff Roy. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Steve. Great to be here.
There may be others joining us. Not everybody can make it, but for this kind of meta topic, you know, what are you doing? What is the show about? Towards a More Perfect Union. That's kind of a lofty topic to start with.
You want to kick it off, Natalia?
I think you should, Jeff. I think okay. I found myself accidentally as part of this group, which I love, but I want to hear first what you think about it.
Well, I will say, you know, having served in local government for 14 years and now state government, I'm in my ninth year and working in the legal system since 1986. Always focusing on a notion of justice has really informed my thinking about what we do as a local community, as a state, and as a nation. And I've always been intrigued with history. And, the Constitution is that body that really sets the foundation for everything we do. And I'm going to read the preamble because that says a lot about who we are and what we're doing. We, the people of the United States, and in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And I think that gives an origin for pretty much what we do in this program, to take from our own individual experiences and try to encapsulate what it means to create a more perfect union. And the discussions that we have always focus on that. And the other thing I will share, and I'll ask anyone who's listening, because you probably can't see us talking, but pull out a dollar bill and look at the back of that dollar bill and look at the great seal of the United States. You'll see it if it's on a coin, and I'm actually holding a coin with the great seal right now, but it's two sides. But if you look on the left side of the back of the dollar bill, there's a pyramid there. And if you look at that pyramid, it's an unfinished pyramid. And it's got 13 levels, which are the 13 original colonies, but the top has not been completed. And it's our job as citizens, and I would dare say my task as a representative is to seek to improve the state of that union and try to finish that pyramid, understanding that we will probably never get to a perfect union, but we can at least leave what we've started in a state where those who follow can continue the fight to improve it. So that's a long way towards going to talk about why we have the conversations we do. We take on some difficult topics, and you have three people who view the world through different lenses and who come together and engage in conversations with the two hosts of the program. And I can tell you from my perspective, they have been some of the most riveting conversations I've engaged in. I look forward to them every week. And that's why I do it.
Let me jump into why I do it. So I'm quite different from Jeff. You know, I don't have 20 years of service experience. In fact, until about a year ago, I wasn't even that politically active. You know, I'll give you a little background. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio to international students. My parents were Greeks. They were in the US. I was born when I was a few weeks old. My mom became a professor of the Medical School of Athens. We moved back to Greece. I grew up there till I was 17. I grew up with this mixed identity of being an American citizen and going to the American school in Athens, and then coming to the US to college for the first time at 17, and then being confused, not knowing where I belonged. And where I felt most at home was science and public health. You know, my parents are both doctors. My mom is an epidemiologist. And that was the sort of, you know, career I aspired to. But then I found myself at the UN in Beirut, in Lebanon. I traveled to Syria and Yemen. I was in Thailand and Ghana. You know, I basically was a very global person because I'd never quite had a sense of home and therefore not a very political. You know, my politics were global politics. I cared about equity. I cared about global rights. And so very, very different background from Jeff. And then COVID hit. And I find myself in Massachusetts at a center at Harvard, frustrated by the politics around COVID and really feeling disillusioned by how few of us in the, you know, public health sphere and the science sphere are engaged in politics. You know, maybe many of you listening in are lawyers, are historians, but I doubt there are many scientists who actually even listen to this show. And that's what I'm here to do, to sort of bring a new perspective, a new angle, maybe some insights that are not, you know, well thought out in the same way. I don't have the experience that, you know, Jeff does or Michael Walker-Jones has, nor the history. You know, I'm the youngest, I would say, on this group, but
excuse
I bring other
me.
I'm sorry. I was born in 1982. When people hear 82, they're kind of shocked. But then when I hear people being born in 2000, and recognizing that these people are already, you know, 21 years old, I'm pretty shocked too. So
yeah. I graduated from college in 1983. So that gives you an indication. You know, I'm so glad that you talked about, you know, your conversations with scientists and, you know, not being particularly politically active. My start in life was on an engineering path at a science, Worcester Polytechnic Institute.
WPI.
And I realized with 2 years of being there that I wasn't a scientist or an engineering material because I was studying computer science, but I was more involved with the social sciences, and that's what led me to leave and get a law degree and eventually get into politics. But when I talk to engineers and scientists about, you know, their programs, for example, I was recently part of a battery energy storage symposium. And I said, folks, you need to engage with your political figures because, you know, they're looking for ways to improve their society and to improve the climate or any number of steps. And they can be tremendous allies on the pathway to success of your scientific innovation or idea. And that's probably why I enjoy chatting with you so much, because you share a perspective like that.
And Jeff, you know, I don't know how many of the listeners know this. I ran for Congress, which was a little crazy to do, but it felt like I was sitting on the sidelines. I was doing what you're talking about, scientists trying to influence policy. You know, actually, a year ago today, I wrote a piece in the Washington Post with Mary Bassett, the former New York City health commissioner. We had had one death in the US, and we called upon the government to pay attention to equity. We said that our deep inequities on racial lines, on income lines, could lead to the worst pandemic among wealthy countries. We thought we were exaggerating. It was written a year ago with one death, and we sort of sounded out an alarm saying, you know, you need to pay attention to this and you need to pay attention to our inequities because this is not going to fare well for the US and it's not going to fare well on equity lines. We know that the people who are going to be hit the hardest are our communities of color and our poorest working Americans. And, you know, I did that. I was being interviewed for the New York Times and everybody. And then I was like, well, this isn't getting us anywhere. Nothing is changing. And then President Trump pulled out of the WHO and I said, okay, I need to run for office because at this point in time, there's such an attack on science that our politicians are simply closing their ears. And, you know, to be honest, I feel like Governor Baker, as of yesterday, opening up the restaurants at full capacity is a similar closing my ears and my eyes to the science and saying, you know, we need to move forward. So I'm excited to be part of this conversation because I want to be a scientist who kind of engages with politics in a real way. And this is why I come on every Thursday, even though, you know, I live in Brookline, I don't live in Franklin, and I'm doing my work here in Brookline too, but I love engaging with this group.
As a listener and a part-time observer for some of the conversations, I think it's interesting to reinforce that, yes, there are multiple perspectives from the three core specifically, as we've talked of so far, but then Frank Falvia, the host, and Pete Fasciano, Franklin TV executive director, they add their background and experience, and it's a healthy discussion. And it's rather thought-provoking. I always come away with like, okay, that's another view. Okay, maybe we can consider that.
And brother love always brings a deep perspective to the conversation, doesn't he?
Well, I guess your question is, you know, what brought us together and what in particular, my particular
why do you do this?
You know, my interest is was really sparked by two things. One, the times are extremely unique with the virus. The subject matter is one that's very close to my heart as both a social scientist as well as a hopefully an influencer of policy. It also gives me an opportunity to interact with people that I highly respect. Natalia, full disclosure, I worked on her campaign. I was extremely impressed with her. Had an opportunity. Now, this is all 12 candidates at one point I had a chance to interact with. So out of the 12, I thought she was the most impressive and the best candidate. Still do, even though Jake is doing okay. But still, I thought she was the I think for the times brought more richness to the table. And Jeff has always been a friend. Jeff and I have worked together since actually the 90s when he was on the school committee and an aspiring politician at that point. I was working for the Mass Teachers Association and also a citizen of Franklin. So I had mixed loyalties there, both to Jeff as a citizen and also one of his supporters when he was on the school board, but also as a teacher advocate So I found myself on many occasions having to recuse myself from some of the local issues that involved Jeff, which the MTA was actually very, very supportive. They gave us a lot of leeway in terms of our own communities. But I found that that relationship in all of these relationships helped to clarify some of the things that I see as problems, and they have longstanding problems. So I guess one of the things that I bring to the conversation is a minority perspective too. As a Black American, you know, I've seen, and as an elderly American, I've seen a lot. And some of which has just repeated itself over and over again: systemic racism, discrimination, problems with regard to unequal justice. These things are very ingrained and passionate with me, so I bring that perspective. And a person of means, you know, I freely admit that I'm blessed living in Franklin and having attained a certain level of freedom and ability economically, but I've never forgotten that that came at a price, not only for me and my family, but for others. There are many of my family members who have not had the opportunities or the breaks that I have. And so I bring that perspective to our conversation. And sometimes it puts me on the left, sometimes it puts me on the right, sometimes it puts me in the center. Not often, but normally I'm either one way or the other. But I'm also very honest.
You need to explain to the listeners, and particularly your co-hosts here, when have you been on the right?
Well, don't forget, you know, I think we had a guest on one time who brought up some issues. And I think it was around the I think it was one of the shows we did on the impeachment. And I found some of his arguments compelling when it came to the idea that, you know, not everyone or not everything from the media, for example, is good. There are times when the media is way off key, when they miss just wide swaths of issues, or they'll concentrate on something that really is irrelevant to an issue. Now, I won't call it fake news, but I will call it editorial choice. And that editorial choice has some impact. I guess that puts me a little bit on the right.
You might find it funny that I am obviously quite politically on the left, but I grew up in a very religious household, very conservative. I've, you know, lived and worked in very conservative settings. So I actually have great comfort with people who have more conservative views, more socially. Although, you know, it was interesting when I was running for office, I actually reached out to the Greek Archbishop and some other leaders in the sort of Greek church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, including the, you know, Syriac Orthodox, other churches. And at some point I was kind of trying to hint at them that my politics are, you know, very progressive, including around abortion and things. And, you know, so I didn't know quite how to pitch it. And they sort of laughed and said, you know, the heavens are with you. Now you need to get the votes and it's okay. Don't tell me too much about what you believe type thing. And I was like, okay, I've managed to sort of balance that. But it was interesting on my campaign run that I don't believe in personal responsibility in the sense that if things are going bad for people, it's not their fault. And somehow I think that is because of my religious upbringing. I do believe that kind of the moral compass that came with being, you know, in a religious household has led me to the very progressive views. And so that kind of inconsistency that some people view, I actually feel is very consistent. I care deeply about equity because that is a religious kind of message that I grew up with. So it's been interesting. I think more immigrants have that kind of melding of progressive politics and religious background, and maybe the Black community too, Michael. I don't know if you agree there.
Well, I agree that there's more conservatism in the Black community than people give credit to. But some of that conservatism really, I think, stems from some social issues like abortion, for example, You know, there's a large number of members of the Black community who are anti-abortion. But then there are a number of social issues too that the Black community and Brown community have had to suffer through because the system is actually reared against them. Social integration, for example, is one where there are a number of folks in the Black community who think that the worst thing that ever happened in our community was integration of the schools. Quickly to explain that, because it brought our kids into an environment where there were people who didn't care about them. And unfortunately, the system, because Black teachers were not as valued as white teachers, the system ended up with a majority of white teachers and not Black teachers when the, you know, when the system integrated. So there was another level of inequity. So I think that there are some areas where when you look closely, you can't just paint any community with one broad brush and say that they're all liberal, that they're all progressive and whatnot. So I agree with Nat D'Elia, you know, that there are many reasons why folks tend to lean one way or the other.
I think one of the amazing things about the conversations that we have and the topics that we touch on is the realization that at the end of the day, there's no real right answer or left answer or centrist answer. You know, I certainly run vigorously as a Democrat when I'm running for the office, and I seek the nomination of the Democratic Party. And when I'm successful in the race, and this year was November 3rd of 2020, I understand that on November 4th, that I've won the race and I represent 44,000 people. And not all 44,000 people are aligned politically with me. And that doesn't matter to me where they are on the spectrum. I am their voice on Beacon Hill. And sometimes I can agree with people and sometimes I can disagree with people. And I think we've had some level of disagreement among us in our conversations on the show, but it has never gotten to the point where we have devolved to name calling or, you know, insulting one another. We hash out our thoughts, we hash out our differences. And it is, to me, goes back to that initial objective of how do you get to a more perfect union if you can't engage in a civilized context with those who may disagree with you. And I struggle at times because people can be downright nasty mm-hmm. in this business. Mm-hmm. And I really don't see the need for it. I don't like to engage in that type of behavior, but I do understand that, you know, people bring a perspective. They bring a box of contextual matter with them to every discussion. Just I loved listening to the backgrounds of everyone on this show. We bring a certain context with us, but again, we have to engage and we have to respect one another. And it's not a matter of right. It's not a matter of left. It's a matter of what's going to, at the end of the day, improve the human condition. And to me, that's the benchmark. And sometimes my colleagues on the right are in the right position. Sometimes my colleagues on the left are in the right position. And invariably, we end up somewhere in between.
Jeff, I love what you said about when you run clearly on the Democratic lane, but then when you represent everyone. You know, when I was running, I didn't have that mindset, but Michael, who, you know, he was a volunteer in my campaign, but much more than that, he was like one of my top advisors, someone who I wanted by my side because of the experience that he has. We were at an event and there was a Blue Lives Matter kind of protest happening where we were supposed to hold signs. And I stood back and Michael said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, you know, we clearly don't see eye to eye on a lot of the things, you know, I'm," and he said, "These are people you will represent. You will be their congresswoman. You walk up there, introduce yourself, say hello, and you represent them, even if you disagree. And that stuck to me. So from that point on, anybody, you know, I would see people, I would go talk to them, and I would tell them who I am. I would listen to their concerns. And it was so eye-opening. So thank you, Michael, for doing that to me. I have been in a bit of a bubble, you know, with kind of the other progressives. And it didn't occur to me that, you know, when you actually represent a district, you represent every single person, whether or not they voted for you, and listening to them is part of your job. So I really took that to heart. And, you know, I've mentioned this on a show, and one town, I interacted with someone who, he walked out to me, he said, "I'm a Republican, do you hate me?" And because of the conversation Michael had with me, I said, "Of course not, I will be your representative." And I sat and talked to him for a very long time. And then he made a huge donation to my campaign. And he said to me, "No Democratic candidate has ever listened to me." And it was very interesting to see how, even within, you know, Jeff, maybe you're a rare case too, that actually listens and has these conversations, but it was eye-opening. So Michael, thank you for having been kind of by my side during this race and you know, really instilling in me what it is to really represent people.
Well, you know, toward that end too, let me say that Natalia opened my eyes on a couple of issues. One was, for example, it's not weighted voting. What is it called, guys?
Ranked choice.
Ranked choice. Because when Natalia hit me with that, because she was very in favor of ranked choice. And I think that was on the ballot, as a matter of fact, should we go to some ranked choice? And I was telling her, oh my God, I'm nowhere near in favor of that. I was almost vehemently opposed. No, that just doesn't work. But then as I did more research and kept an open mind on the back end, I even read the materials. I encountered a National Public Radio expose, well, not expose, but report on ranked choice and how it worked. And come to find out, I was totally mistaken. And now I am I'm a huge proponent of it, as a matter of fact. In its form, the way it's used in Ireland, because ranked choice is a way for everyone's vote to make a difference. And one of the other things too that Natalia opened my eyes to, even though she may not want to take credit for this one, which is the idea that we have a two-party system in this country. And I've always had this as sort of an inner feeling, but now it's become much more of a feeling. And that is that our two-party system is a contrived system that keeps us really, I think, from progressing. Nothing in the Constitution establishes a two-party system. And now, as I even listen to the political rhetoric, it's beginning to disturb me, because Democrats are talking about we need a strong two-party system. That's why we got to bolster up Republicans. No, we don't. We don't need a two-party system. What we need are the interests of folks who can come together and coalesce to be represented. And if that means we have 4, 5, 10, 15 different parties, that's what it means. You know, there should never be, I think, in this country, a view that every choice that we make is a binary choice. And I think that's what keeps a lot of our conversation going. Okay. It's because we start to look at those conversations and those issues from multiple facets. And I think that's one of the benefits that all of us bring to that conversation.
You know, you should consider the evolution of the parties in the United States. I mean, we haven't always had a Republican Party. We haven't always had a Democrat Party. You know, the Whigs were popular back in the day. But let me share with you this story from my upbringing, and perhaps it'll shed some light on this topic. So my great-grandfather came from Italy and landed in Milford, Massachusetts in 1895. And I remember reading his obituary. He died somewhere around 1938, 1939. In his obituary, it listed him as a very prominent Republican. And, you know, I would have people who would come to me and say, you know, you come from a Republican family. And, you know, what is it that How do you think your great grandfather would feel about you being a Democrat? And so I went back and I looked at his life and the things that he did. Now, so he came to Milford in 1895. He established a business, and I have his business card. He was a real estate broker, a steamship agent, a dealer in Italian produce, an insurance agent, a notary public, a banker, all of these titles surrounding him on his card. And when immigrants, Italian immigrants would come, the first stop they would do if they came to the Milford area was go see my Uncle Giuseppe. And he would, you know, provide them with a house, money, some food. And, you know, and I'm looking, I said, okay, so we're in the early 1900s. Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican in that day and age. And Teddy Roosevelt would not be a Republican in 2021. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it, and I remember making my inaugural speech on the House floor and talking about this very thing. And I say, you know, if my great-grandfather was here today, I think he'd be very proud of the work that we are doing. And I think he'd be very proud of the fact that I'm a Democrat, because the evolution of the parties from 1895 to 2021 is quite dramatic. And the principles that the parties stand for in that 100-year history are dramatically different. But at the end of the day, we're all Americans, and we're all striving for that, you know, idea of improving the human condition and helping one another. And it goes back to what you were saying, Natalia, at the beginning, those religious principles. You know, I was raised Catholic, and, you know, we do look back at our moral compass and our upbringing and what we want to do. And I think, you know, even though I don't agree philosophically with some of the folks on the other side of the aisle, I know their deep commitment, and in their heart, they want to do the right thing. It's just that pathway of how we get there is where we differ.
And, you know, that brings up a very interesting evolutionary piece as well. My all of my ancestors up until the 1940s were Republicans. And easy to understand, it was the party of Lincoln. Teddy Roosevelt, for example, was one of the first presidents that my great-grandmother became cognizant of. She was born in 1899. But it was later on when FDR won elections or won his first election that the Black community started to do some shifting. In the 1950s and 60s, that was solidified when more and more of the Republicans, especially in the South, started to go more and more toward segregationist tendencies. Because if you study history, prior to that, it was the Democrats who were the segregationists. So the evolution of the parties, I think, can be studied from some of these shifts in communities. And if anyone ever goes to, for example, and there's some proof in this, you go to Philadelphia, you go to the Early American Black Museum that's in Philadelphia, and you look at some of those testimonials, beautifully done with these holographic images. And there are people who talk about, well, I just voted for the Republican, blah, blah, which shocks a lot of Black folks who go there. believe me, I was standing there with my wife and was absolutely shocked when I saw this one family who gasped when they were listening to this family described, oh yeah, we're staunch Republicans, and you know, and they were going, what? You know, because they didn't really understand or know that history, you know, which is part of my evolution again. And this group has been extremely helpful for me because it gives me an opportunity with Natalia and with Jeff, you know, to verbalize some of that those feelings that are inside.
And you know. It's interesting that you both can talk about your grandparents in the U.S. I think for the immigrants in the U.S., our sort of experience and narratives actually shape a lot more too. You know, in Greece, there was a civil war in the 40s. And I know that my grandfather was sent to exile because he was a communist or not a communist. He never admitted to it, but he was exiled. And my mother, when she went to medical school, she was denied, you know, she came from a small village, not very poor family. Her father was a baker, so she had some means, but she was denied a scholarship because she had to sign that, you know, she would deny the Communist Party. And she said, my father was never a communist. Like, they had never admitted to it. But, you know, it's interesting how growing up, they never really talked about, I didn't know who they were voting for because they had this fear of civil war. And I think, you know, that kind of experience also shapes when I saw what happened on January 6th, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a coup, you know. And for anybody who grew up in Latin America, who's an immigrant, you know, our sense of like the stories from our grandparents, you know, having to actually fight civil wars to fight for democracy shapes that. So it's interesting to hear your sort of how that shapes your position today, and how it shapes mine is recognizing that, you know, my grandfather, he was giving bread to like the everybody in the village. And so he was deemed a communist because he was giving it for free during the war and was exiled, you know, but I obviously admire him for doing that. And it's interesting, but I'm sure I'm missing a lot of information because my parents were quite silent about their political views when I was growing up. Now I think I should ask them.
Well, and to that end, to pull a couple of points together for the listeners, I think the glory of this group, as people have been listening, is with the different perspectives, you're putting aside the labels, because clearly labels can put people into pigeonholes and boxes, et cetera, et cetera. The devil's in the details. And clearly there's an evolution piece. We need to be mindful of the history, but we need to know where we're going and how are we going to get there. And that's, I think, what you're working through in a civil discourse, which, yay, we need that. So I continue to encourage you to do what you're doing. And hopefully with this, we'll be able to get more listeners and get more engagement and more conversations.
You know, one of the things that has come out of our conversations, and I've known Michael for ages, I mean, going back 20, 30 years, but he knows I like to travel. He knows I like to do what I call these magical history tours. And we're talking about putting together a trip where we're gonna travel the civil rights trail, you know, Mobile, Alabama, Monroeville, Alabama, Montgomery, Alabama, Selma, Tuskegee, Birmingham, and I think our goal is to end up at the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta, and we're putting that together. And if you think these radio shows are good now, wait till you hear us broadcasting from those venues.
Wait, can I join you? This sounds we would love phenomenal. To have you.
We're putting the details together, and when we get it all set up, we're going to invite people who want to come and join us.
Toward that end, I'd let the listeners know if Jeff, I don't know if they're going to make this public or not, but I will make it known that we're going to have. I've already confirmed that we will have at least an opportunity to go to the Capitol building in Montgomery. We may have an opportunity to meet the governor. We're going to meet the commissioner of higher education there, possibly the head of the Department of Labor. We're going to have a tour at, now these are things that I've already confirmed, Jeff. All we need are the dates.
You are beautiful.
We're going to be able to go to Troy University. That's Troy. Troy University is in Troy, Alabama, and that's where John Lewis was born. As a matter of fact, the president there may hold a reception for us. I'm not sure, but you know, but that's one of the things in the work. I know you will get to meet Dr. Hawkins and hear a little bit from him. He's a wonderful Southern gentleman. It is wonderful to be able to go and historically, you know, I think, walk in the footsteps of some of that history. But there's also too going to be a lot of poignant as well as I think sad moments, because in that history, there are some things too, that I think it's important for people to know: the violence, the vehemence, the anger that was held during those times. And that's one of the things that in our conversations, we bring the history, but what we don't bring is the judgment, whether it was right or wrong, it happened. Yes, there is a particular point of view from all sides, but at the same time, we as modern human beings have to gauge how have we progressed from that? How have we changed? And I think your last piece there, Jeff, in terms of how it's evolving is really key. And I know it's key for me because I want to make sure that in our conversation, and I think Natalia, you bring something that for me has forever been, you know, I think of interest. And that is the perspective of how we're doing. Because much of what my generation has done is now up for scrutiny, folks. Okay. And I'm always interested in my kids, especially my youngest kids who are closer to age to Natalia, and Jeff, your generation, which is now taking over from all of us, from all of us older folks. The question is, how did we do? And I'm not so sure we did well, but we tried. And I think it's up to Jeff and Natalia to do better. And that's the other thing too that I try to bring to this, which is to keep pushing them. We also bring truth and data. That's something else too, that if our listeners go. And one of the other things that I'm working on is I hope to start to bring in, as Frank, our sort of mentor and leader in this effort, has sort of directed us, Steve, which is a broader state and national perspective. I'm working on a national guest, as a matter of fact, a couple of them. In a few weeks, we're going to be doing some stuff on reparations. I hope to bring a national guest in with us for that. The other piece that I think is really important is what you're doing with us here, Steve, which is to not only expose us to the Franklin community, but get some buzz going around this. That's one of the sort of pieces that I, you know, that I worry about is whether or not anybody is really listening, because we don't get the kind of feedback that we should. And I've got some ideas about that too, but, you know, I'll save that when we wrap up.
Hey, I'll know in November of 2022 if they were listening.
How true. How true.
You know, Michael, you asked a question, and I know it was a rhetorical question, but I want to say this. You asked, how did we do? And, you know, I glorify in the history of what we have been left with. Has it been perfect? Have all the decisions been absolutely correct that have been made? Certainly not. But we always knew that, you know, we weren't going to be perfect, but we would try and we would work together. And the fact that this nation stays together, has survived the Civil War, has survived two world wars, survived an insurrection on January 6th, is testimony to the fact that something's right, and we're doing the right things, and we're opening our hearts and opening our eyes and opening our ears, and that's all good things. It's a long path, and as Martin Luther King Jr. said so well, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And I think we may not get there, but we know that that's the path we're on. And, you know, take pride in what you have done and what you and your generation has done. And I take pride in the work that my generation has done. And I am confident in the future generations that are coming along that they will build and continue to build and get us to that more perfect union.
I know that's probably the best place, Steve, for you to end, but instead of me jumping in and saying, but climate change, but racial justice. So you might not want to include this, but I know that the younger generation is angry at us. And I have heard so many 18, 17 year olds truly feeling anxious that they have no future. They are saying to me, why should I think about what I want to study in college when there is no planet that I can live on? And that eco-anxiety was not my generation. I did not grow up in high school worrying about the planet basically, you know, not being able to hold us. But I do think the 16, 17-year-olds are going through this tremendous anxiety. And that is where not, you know, it's not Michael's generation or your generation, Jeff, or my generation. It's all of us. We have failed, and it's not a U.S. thing. It is a global thing, but the U.S. is one of the biggest emitters. So we need to take that, you know, that kind of challenge literally. And I think on the racial justice piece, we can't say that we've moved fast enough. So those are the two areas. And lastly, poverty. You know, I have been working with Reverend Barber's Poor People's Campaign. Poverty in this country, one of the wealthiest country, the fact that I think it's something like one in four children grow up in poverty in the United States, that is something that I am not proud of, and something that I think we can and should demand to do better. So I love, you know, maybe Steve, you will end with Jeff's sort of optimism, but
oh, please don't. Please don't end with the optimism. Understand that we have challenges ahead of us, but we have the right people to address those challenges, and we can do it. I mean, when I was 13 years old, okay, I was glued to the TV watching the hearings over the Watergate investigation. Mm-hmm. And I was extremely fearful that the government that I so loved and revered was collapsing in front of me. And I wondered, how does a nation survive the removal of a president? And how do we reinstill faith in our institutions? And I was genuinely afraid as a 13-year-old. But you know something? I think, you know, we came out of that. And we've come out of so many adverse situations. And we are addressing climate change. We had a four-year lapse on that. But, you know, things are happening at lightning speed. And we have commitments and goals in place. And, you know, my new position in the state legislature as the chair of the telecommunications, utilities, and energy is putting me right at the forefront of the climate change piece. So, Natalia, I'll be reaching out to you on a number of occasions. I know we've already talked about it, but we've got the ability to rescue this planet. And I want kids who are growing up in this world to understand that there is a great and bright future ahead of them.
Well, you know, look, I'm gonna pour a little bit of cold water back on this, piece again too.
Because, hey, keep trying, man. You know,
this ebbs and flows. This is the nature of the conversation. That's the way it goes.
It is because see, from my perspective, you know, look, my great grandmother, my grandmother, my uncles, they saw something that continues to this day, and that is the persecution and terrorism of Black people in this country, the inequity of Black people in this country. And, you know, at first, even I was ignorant, totally ignorant of the history of what real systemic racism was. I'm going to give Jeff credit for the his bill and the passage of the legislation requiring civics in our public schools in Massachusetts. It's a great first step. But at the same time, what happens to the teaching of real history? Why is it that I didn't realize that the federal government after World War II and after World War I, discriminated against Black soldiers, one, by not giving them all of the benefits of the GI Bill, too, by not allowing them to get a mortgage under the VA administration. Three, not giving them the idea that you can go get healthcare from VA. They were discriminated at the VA hospitals. Then we look at the violence perpetrated against the Black community by the police. We've got a long way to go. And again, I plead, guilty to the fact that our generation did not focus enough on and some of it too was intentional on the part of the police and the government to keep us suppressed. We did not focus and give our voices loudly enough to opposition to the police and the oppression that the police brought into our communities. Our young people today, though, are not tolerating it. So that's good. And I agree with Natalia in that regard. But again, Jeff, I applaud your optimism. I agree. We've got a long way to go. The path and the issues that we have to deal with are broad. That's why this has to be a broad conversation. But I am so pleased that every week we get to take a little sliver of that and between us at least dialogue it and hopefully demonstrate and model how that dialogue can take place in a very, I think, not only peaceful, progressive, but with some intent to try to rectify the problem at the end of the day.
And I think just to kind of close off, being mindful of your respective time commitments, et cetera, I think for those listening, you've heard some of the issues, teasers, if you will, some of the different perspectives. And I think Jeff mentioned, you've got the right people in the conversation with one difference. What we want to do is bring other people so that we have all the right people in the conversation to make it truly the diverse and civil discourse that we need so that we can move towards the more perfect union. So thank you, Natalia. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Michael. And on behalf of Pete and Frank, who are all the co-hosts who couldn't make it with us today, I encourage all the listeners to participate. Clay, I think you record on a Thursday, but the shows are effectively on Monday. We'll include those details in the show notes so people can find out and listen and participate and ultimately engage and potentially be, participating more actively as we go forward in this. Yeah. So.
And folks should know and understand we do have guests on here. We've had some conservative guests on the show. We've had some liberal guests on the show, but it's always been a great conversation. And Steve, I want to thank you for doing this show today. And Natalia and Michael, thank you for being great partners in this effort. And to Frank and Pete, enjoy your company and enjoy your wisdom that you bring to the table as well.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.